holes of golf in one day. Even crazier than playing that much golf in one day is the money the event raised, which is $1 million. What isn't crazy is the beneficiary families, who are dealing with cancer. This two-day event called Golf Fights Cancer is hoping to repeat last year's huge windfall. Since it all started in 2005, the event has raised $10 million, and two of the players and original organizers are from North Andover, and they have a little more skin in this particular marathon. A sports-oriented power couple, Ed and Diane Lynch, were there when this started, lending a sort of bittersweet aspect to the event. The bitter part is why they are involved, and that story also began in 2003 when they moved into a quaint North Andover neighborhood called Hickory Hill behind Barker Farm. We didn't know anybody. We were living in New York, and I grew up in Reading. North Andover was somewhere in the middle for both of us. It was also close enough to the airports. Ed flew in from New York City a lot, and I traveled a little bit, but could work remotely. It was Columbus Day, exactly 3 months into their move, that their 3-year-old son, Jack, was quickly brought to his pediatrician after waking up with bruises under his eyes. He had other issues previously unable to be diagnosed, including him walking with a limp. This ailment concerned mom and dad, so they brought him to his pediatrician, who met them in the parking lot and said that Jack needed to be seen immediately at Tufts Medical. Within hours, Jack was diagnosed with leukemia. When they called for oncology, we knew it probably wasn't good, said the family. Jack spent the next 3 weeks in the hospital while mom basically moved in. She was also 7 months pregnant with child number 2, Aiden, at the time. 3 weeks into this, 3 years of doctor's visits, tests, radiation, or chemo treatments, including 6 months of back-to-forth visits, getting experimental treatments at the famed Memorial Sloan Kettering Center of New York City. They had a Merrimack College student start out as a babysitter, later moving in with the family full-time. She ended up graduating while living with us, said Diane, and she was a blessing for us. The Lynches realized early on that they didn't just move into a nice neighborhood in North Andover, they moved into a village. People were cleaning our house, they were bringing food every day, and some of them complete strangers, said Diane. Getting a little emotional, while it was really tough for us, on the other hand, it was truly uplifting. It was amazing what so many people did for us, just amazing. There were trying times, and Jack eventually passed away at the age of 6 in November of 2006. A month later, Diane gave birth to son number 3, Thomas. That's the way our life was, said Diane. There was always something important facing us. Fighting cancer through golf. Before Jack's initial diagnosis, current PGA president Jay Monahan, who had been running the PGA's bank event at TPC Boston, and former Navy SEAL Brian Oates, attended the funeral of a colleague who died from cancer. They decided to run the Boston Marathon in 2003 and raise money on behalf of a friend who passed from cancer. Monahan had relationships with both Ed and Diane through their sports media business. Diane was the Major League Soccer, and Ed was a video production company. When Monahan heard about Jack's fight, he and Oates decided to run the 2004 Boston Marathon to help raise money for the Lynches, including helping with the mortgage, transportation, etc. Talk about a godsend. Diane had to quit her job, said Ed. It was incredible and very much appreciated. It helped us out big time, including with hospital bills and other things. In a meeting with Monahan and Oates, the Lynches took the marathon idea and brought it to the golf course. The Golf Fights Cancer Marathon was born in 2005. They picked a charity with ties to cancer. We started out with the Stowe Acres with 12 of us playing, recalled Ed. The guy that owned the course donated it for the day, and we played and played and played round by round. It was exhausting. They raised $37,000. We realized that we had gone through that we didn't want it research-based at the beginning. We bought a blood machine for the Tufts Floating Hospital, and it saved parents time from testing every 4 hours. By 2013, they raised $100,000, and in 2015, over $200,000. This year, they're hoping to match last year's $1 million. One development from the event is that the golfers can dictate which cancer outlet the money goes to. The want golfers from North Andover, most members of the North Andover Country Club will be donating to One Summit, which helps kids battle cancer through experiential learning with Navy SEAL mentors. Diane also happens to be the executive director for One Summit. This idea of building resilience in patients and their siblings is truly honoring the life that Jack lived, said Diane. Jack really taught our family to be resilient and become stronger. I can help any family through this transition, the struggle. It is the biggest gift of all. Last year, One Summit golfer specifically raised over $50,000 but got a check from the Golf Fights Cancer for $87,000. All golfers from North Andover were expected to raise about $3,000 each. Two other North Andover guys, John Diaz, who is a Golf Fights Cancer board member, and James Yonchak will be paying to raising money for GFC. So as to help, has to help defray the cost of the course on Thursday and Friday. As for the actual golf part, on the 100-hole event, Ed, for one, has figured a way to find a shortcut or two, or three. He and his partners will play three balls on one par three and two balls on every par four and one ball on every par five. It definitely speeds up the process by a few hours, said Ed, who is expected to be on the course about 8 hours. But there are other guys who play all 100 holes, and they're legit, which takes about 12 or 13 hours. Either way, it's a blast for all of us. Dan Fay, whose eldest son, Jack, is the same age as Jack Lynch would have been, will be playing with his two sons, Jack and Tyler. He's been playing almost since the marathon event began. Ed and Diane are two special, special people, said Fay. To think about what they went through, their resilience is inspiring. I haven't seen a lot of people not only handle what happened to their oldest son, but handle it with such a positive way. It was 17 years ago, and they are still keeping Jack's name at the top of everybody's mind. I've never seen them waver, never, and it's an honor to know them. Okay, over to you, Matt.
All right. I'll be reading a story called UMass Challenged by Cost and Enrollment Trends by Allison Kuznets. Declining enrollment and swelling employee expenses are causing budget woes for the University of Massachusetts, and financial help from Beacon Hill may be needed, according to a top university official. Salary and fringe benefits constitute 60% of UMass's expenses in fiscal 2024, an increase of $186 million compared to the fiscal 2023 projection. Joe, assistant budget director at UMass, attributed the figure to an 11% hike and to the state fringe rate and an 8% union wage increase. The costs will need to be funded in future budgets, he said. He told UMass trustees on May 31st during a virtual Committee on Administration and Finance meeting. Quote, addressing these challenges will require active management and continued advocacy for a change to the cost-sharing arrangement with the Commonwealth, he said. Overall, UMass enrollment is slated to decrease by 0.3% in fiscal 2024, capping a three-year downward trend, he said. That's fueled by a 1% drop in undergraduate students and a 2% drop in in-state students, though the percentage of graduate, out-of-state, and international students is projected to rise, as well as those pursuing continued education. UMass President Marty Meehan warned that the university system is sailing into some, quote, very strong headwinds, end quote, with enrollment pressures sparked by lower birth rates, more competition for students, and people questioning the return on investment from a college degree. UMass has managed to save more than $100 million through procurement strategies to prepare for the looming hurdles, Meehan said. Quote, our enrollment is certainly stronger than the community colleges, the state universities, and the non-elite private, Meehan said. But we know what's coming. Headwinds are coming. Enrollment at UMass Amherst is expected to be 29,835 for fiscal year 2024, a 1.2% drop from the prior year that also reflects officials attempting to, quote-unquote, right-size the incoming undergraduate class. UMass Lowell is projected to see a 0.8% decline, while UMass Boston and UMass Dartmouth will see upticks of 0.8% and 1.6% respectively. Boosting the volume of applications could alleviate some of UMass's struggles, Meehan said. Applications for fiscal 2024 fall admissions neared 93,000, which was historically high, said Lee Ann Pasquini, assistant vice president for budget and planning. Yet deposits, an indication of student commitments so far, were lower compared to last year. All the UMass campuses should maintain a positive operating margin in the coming fiscal year, with the overall figure pegged at 1.8%. Quote, achieving these margins come with challenges posed by the enrollment decline, sharp increases in employee benefit costs, and historic union wage increase. The campuses have had to make tough decisions around staffing and other non-personnel spending in order to achieve these margins. There are difficult solutions embedded in their budgets, and the campuses are actively working on implementing them for the coming fiscal year. Trustee Bob Epstein said, quote-unquote, tough decisions will need to be made on all aspects to ensure UMass reaches a 2% operating margin by fiscal year 2025. UMass's $4.1 billion budget covers 15,601 full-time employees, which is a 1% drop in general operating staff. Officials said it's too early to know which positions will be impacted at the different campuses, but overall, staffing will increase by 0.8% due to grant funding. Quote, we'll continue to focus on financial accountability and work towards maximizing cost-saving initiatives through shared services to offset some of the budget challenges that we've discussed, and overall, keep the university financially strong. All right, back to you, Bianca.
This next article is titled Documents and Police Officers Forgery Case Sealed Through Summer. In Methuen, investigative documents in a criminal corruption case against a former Methuen police officer accused of forging his training credentials are now sealed from public view until August 31st. Also, former police officer Sean Fountain is not expected to be back in the Lawrence District Court until September 7th. He was previously scheduled to return to court Wednesday for a probable cause hearing. The impoundment order sealing affidavits and other reports from public view, left unchallenged, was supposed to lapse on July 3rd. The name of an accused co-conspirator is among the details under seal, authorities said. Fountain 50 is a city councilor from 2012 to 2017, and later a police officer in Methuen from 2017 to 2020. He was arraigned in Lawrence District Court on April 6th on 8 counts, including conspiracy, forgery, and violating employee standards of conduct. He is accused of forging a document showing he attended a police academy, which he did not, following his questionable hiring by retired Methuen Police Chief Joseph Solomon, authorities said. Following the arraignment, Essex County District Attorney Paul Tucker and State Attorney General Andrew Campbell both confirmed that they are continuing to investigate alleged criminal wrongdoing by Fountain and possibly others. While it's unclear why Fountain's case is being delayed, court delays and rescheduling are common. Excuse me. At this time, the Essex County Grand Jury has not handed down any indictments against Fountain. Should he face indictment, however, Fountain's case would be transferred to Salem Superior Court, where the penalties he would face if convicted would be more severe. In April, to obtain a criminal complaint against Fountain, Methuen Police Chief Scott McNamara submitted 300 pages of investigative analysis to a Lawrence District Court clerk magistrate. This followed an 18-month investigation into Mr. Fountain and others, led by McNamara and police captain Eric Ferreira, and a report compiled by an outside firm that cost the city $60,000. At the heart of the numerous investigations in recent months is whether Fountain had ever had the proper qualifications, training, and credentials to be a police officer. Following Fountain's arrest, Methuen Mayor Neil Perry and the City Council released a letter pressing for a variety of local and state law enforcement and ethnics agencies to further investigate Fountain. Tucker and Campbell subsequently issued a joint statement saying that the offices are investigating. No bail was set in the case of Fountain remains free on personal recognizance. He entered a plea of not guilty at his arraignment. Fountain's defense attorney, Neil Fagel, declined comment for this article. Back to you, Matt.
All right. This next story is from Lowell. Titled Lowell Alliance awarded $90,000. So this is for the Cummings Foundation grants to expand diaper and community training programs. On average, a newborn baby goes through 10 to 12 diapers a day, which can mean parents and caregivers could be changing up to 4,000 diapers in 1 year. That's a lot of diapers, said Nancy Cohn, the director for the Lowell Alliance. The nonprofit's primary mission is to educate and improve residents' access to community resources, but is also known for its extensive diaper bank outreach for rural area families. Through our agency partners, we're providing diapers to between 80 to 100 families per month, Cohen said by phone on Tuesday. Every month, between 10 to 15 agencies pick up diapers from Rural Alliance to distribute to the families on their caseload. But the work has become substantially harder since the end of pandemic-era funding, which Cohen said had left her worrying about how Rural Alliance is going to be able to sustain the level of diapers needed for the families served. Thanks to a $90,000 grant over the next 3 years by the Cummings Foundation, the organization will now be able to reach more residents through its diaper bank program, as well as expand its interactive grassroots workshop training called Empower, Building Leaders, Strengthening Communities. The Woburn-based Cummings Foundation was established in 1986 and has grown to be one of the largest private foundations in New England. It aims to give back in the areas where it owns commercial property. This $30 million Cummings grant program primarily supports Massachusetts-based nonprofits that are based in and serve Middlesex, Essex, and Suffolk counties. Quote, 65% of this grant is going to go to the diaper bank, and the rest is going to go to our civic engagement work. Empower is our grassroots leadership development program that we've been running now for about 7 years, end quote. In 2016, Rural Alliance, in partnership with Coalition for a Better Acre, started training residents who are looking for more ways to get involved in making change in their community. Quote, thanks to the Cummings Foundation, we'll be able to expand this program, Cohen said, adding that just more than 100 people have already graduated from the 9-week workshop series. The workshop pulls in experts to speak on leadership and community organizing, advocacy, communication skills, public speaking, how to organize meetings, and grant writing. An important component of what the training includes what Cohen called, quote unquote, field trips to City Hall. Just 1 second. During which residents meet with a city councilors and attend a council meeting to see how government works and how they can participate in the process. We're looking to build our workshops to create and maintain a network for students to get to know each other and support one another in their work in the community, she said. Planning in that one-to-one engagement is easier with the support of the Cummings 3-year funding, which Cohen called critical support for the small nonprofit. Quote, what I really appreciate about the Cummings Foundation is that they get in terms of the multi-year grant. She said, we're a very small player in the nonprofit community, and it's hard to plan for the future. When we can count on something coming in for 3 years, it's an amazing feeling of thinking sustainably. While the Rural Alliance plans for the future, it still must meet the diaper needs of today. But Cohen says its two signature projects are linked through community outreach. Quote, the diaper project is a necessary band-aid on a problem, she said. Through Empower, we're seeking to get at the roots of that issue and make changes at that level. The grant funding gives the Rural Alliance some breathing room to grow both the diaper program and the Empower programs, but she said the nonprofit isn't resting on our laurels and will keep pushing to provide services in the community. Quote, we expect our diaper distribution to increase through our agencies to between 120 to 130 families per month. I think we're going to start accepting a few new families who don't have transportation that we will deliver diapers to. The nonprofit accepts both cash and diaper donation, and when they welcome any brand, Cohen, who has shopped diapers for many years, says the best diaper value is the Walmart house brand called Parents' Choice. People get it, she said, when describing donations to meet the needs in the community. Food pantries are at or over capacity and under-resourced, and diaper banks are the same. To donate diapers and for more information, contact Nancy Cohen at ncohen, that's N-C-O-A-N, at ywcaofrural.org. The Rural Alliance also welcomes cash donations for diaper purchases. Back to you, Bianca.
This next article is titled Voters Okay Debt Exclusion. Property taxes will jump to pay for a $160 million project. In Haverhill, voters in Haverhill agreed to reach deep into their pockets to pay for a new $160 million Constantino School by approving a property tax increase by a vote of 3,182 to 2,734. The so-called debt exclusion proposition is two halves override with one of two methods put forward to fund the project. Of Haverhill's 47,000 registered voters, 5,916 cast their ballots, bringing turnout to about 14% of voters. City Clerk Caitlin Wright said that there is a good deal of interest in the special election, as 2,696 people as of Monday had voted early by the mail and 220 voted early in person. It was the first time the city held universal vote by mail for a special election. In this special election, voters answered yes or no to a single ballot question on whether to approve a tax increase to pay for a new Constantino Middle School. Two funding plans had been put forward, one to roll over expiring Hale Hospital debt payments and also use a small portion of the city's tax levy capacity, which the mayor defines as money the city did not tax in the past but can tax in the future. The other plan is a debt exclusion, which will raise taxes specifically to pay for the Constantino, which the city borrows money while leaving the city's tax levy capacity for other uses such as employee pay raises, a new fire station, or other big projects without the need to ask the voters' approval. The mayor had said that a new school would be built regardless of how the vote turned out. City Councilor and Morale candidate Melinda Barrett was elated with the results, saying that yes for Constantino, grassroots organization of parents, teachers, city officials, and other members of the community did an excellent job on their campaign, especially the co-chairs Nate Hartwell and Joanna Dix of a Haverhill school teacher. Their team and the leadership shown by the state representative Andy Varga, City Council President Tim Jordan, and Councilor John Mitchison, along with the school committee men Rich Rosa for former City Councilor Colin LePage, combined to provide a win for the Haverhill today. She said, "I supported them from the beginning and did whatever I could to help them provide them with the resources they needed to win." Dix was waiting outside the city clerk's office when the vote totals arrived. "The vote will help the city move forward and ensure that it is fully funded for its fire department, our infrastructure, and maintaining our schools, which is why the school is so important to us." She said that our campaign included sending out mailings, setting up 30 signs, and using social media. "I think that it was very effective, as we explained in videos what a debt exclusion is, and we use Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, and other social medias to get out our message. We'll have more funding to provide for basic public safety, education, roads, and other new school facilities that are needed. I feel that this is it was a fairly close race, and as I went door to door week after week, I met a lot of people who were in favor of the debt exclusion, but I also met people who liked the concept, but because of economic times and their financial situation, they didn't have the funds to support it. I want to thank the voters for considering the debt exclusion and for voting for it. Looking ahead, in January, a lot of the fund, $404 million, will be allotted to Whittier Tech." Okay, back to you.
All right. This next article is from Wilmington by Pete Currier. It's called "Mixed Feelings on New School Consolidation Options." In Wilmington, town officials expressed mixed reactions to a proposal to add additional grade configuration and building options to the plan to study consolidating Wilmington schools into fewer buildings. The Select Board, School Committee, and Financial Committee and School Building Committee met May 31st in a joint meeting to hear from Superintendent of Schools Glenn Brand, Town Manager Jeff Hull, and Project Managers about adding new options to the Wildwood Early Childhood Center project. The town and school are examining three potential options to deal with the sudden closure of the Wildwood Early Childhood Center last year and to potentially consolidate the number of schools in the district to have fewer buildings. The first option is to renovate and make additions to the Wildwood building, which serves preschool and kindergarten, and keep the existing grade and building configuration that exists today. The second option would be converting a school building into a preschool to third grade facility. This would result in either the permanent closure of the Wildwood or Reuben Street Elementary School, while the other serves as the preschool to third grade space. This option, project managers said, would be scrapped if the town chooses to study the new consolidation options. The third option would be to create a preschool to fifth grade facility, with renovations to either one of the Wildwood building or the Reuben building or the North Intermediate School building, while the two that are not chosen would be closed. The first of the new options, which project managers from Dorr and Whittier and SMMA said would need to be brought to the Massachusetts School Building Authority, would be to make at least one preschool building into a preschool to fourth grade facility and shift to eighth graders into the Williams High School and fifth graders into the Wilmington Middle School. This could come with options to have a preschool to fourth grade school either at Wildwood, Reuben, or North, serving students on Wilmington's north side, or to have a single preschool to fourth grade school serving the entire town. The second new option would be to have a preschool to fifth grade facility either at Wildwood, Reuben, or North for the town's north side, or to have a single new facility for the preschool to fifth grade for the whole town, while up to six of the district's school buildings are retired. At the joint meeting, Brand said that Dorr and Whittier have identified the middle school and high school as having more potential space for students than is being used right now, which would support a grade reconfiguration between both schools. Dorr and Whittier project manager Randy Phillip said that there is uneven usage of capacity across the entire district. Quote, "There is a mismatch in capacity between the existing facilities and actual enrollment," he said. "The Bootwell Early Childhood Center and Reuben are over capacity, while West Intermediate School, North Intermediate School, Wilmington Middle School, and Wilmington High School are below the student capacity." Quote, "There appears to be more than enough capacity in the district. It is just all in the wrong places," Phillip said. Brand also notes that there could be issues with that plan, not because of spacing, but because of incompatible programming for the existing building. Typically, when the eighth grade is brought into a high school, it is done when a new facility is built, with that change in mind, said Brand. SLMA Director of Owner Project Management Services, Julie LaDuke, said that the MSBA encouraged the joint meeting to present these newly identified options for potential consolidation, and that if the town does choose to add these new options for consideration, it will move the project back one phase. "We would move back from the feasibility study phase into the eligibility period," said LaDuke, adding that if that is done, the project would get back to its current feasibility study phase in October, turning it from a 7-year project into an 8-year project. After the presentation by the project managers, multiple town officials expressed some frustration that these new options were only being presented to them for the first time then, and that they wished for more time for review before they were compelled to vote on potentially delaying the Wildwood project. Quote, "How can we vote on something tonight when we haven't had time to discuss it? If you asked us to vote, I recommend we do not take a vote because we do not have enough information yet," said Selectman Board Chair Gary DePalma. Select Board Member Frank West had concerns about the potential of consolidating Wilmington's schools to the point of possibly six buildings being closed. "When you consolidate buildings, what happens 30 years from now if we only have three schools and one of them failed for some reason?" West asked. Brand noted that the joint meeting was simply meant to present new options to look into for the Wildwood project, and was not meant to get any sort of commitment to one particular plan. Quote, "Nothing ventured, nothing gained," said Brand, in support of exploring the new options. "This isn't a commitment or a sign-on, and it certainly isn't a commitment to a particular project. I think it is something worth considering as a community," Brand added. Finance Committee member Brad Jackson spoke on his experience as a superintendent in the Holliston Public Schools. Quote, "I wish I could go back 25 years and have the conversation we're having now and to have the study these people are proposing," said Jackson. "It is worth the wait for 1 year to have a comprehensive look at all of our options. We have to look out by 20 or 30 years. Jackson noted that many of Wilmington's existing school buildings are many decades old, and sooner or later will have to be replaced anyways. Quote, "To study this, to me, is a no-brainer," said Jackson. "It could yield a more short-term, expensive solution that may not be politically viable in this community, but that is the information the community needs to make an intelligent, well-informed decision." Without specifying which, Jackson remarked that he thinks some of the consolidation options being presented are, quote, "horrible," and others are, quote, unquote, "awesome." School Committee Chair David Ragsdale said he personally does not like the idea of moving 5th and 8th graders up to new buildings due to what he said are differently structured educational programs. Quote, "You can put it in the building, but that doesn't mean that the education program fits there or can mesh properly with the high school," said Ragsdale. Regardless, Ragsdale said he sees the benefits in having more consolidation options to explore in depth before such a big decision can be made for Wilmington. Quote, "I hate the idea of a delay, but we have to look long term. For the length these kids are expected to be in these buildings, a 6 to 8 month delay is not much," said Ragsdale. As a next step, The individual boards and communities that are party to the Radwood Project will have to vote at their next meeting in June whether to accept the new potential consolidation options and resubmit to the MSBA. In an informal, quote-unquote, hand-raised vote taken at the joint meeting to gauge the overall feeling towards the new options, a vast majority from the committees indicated that they would support it, but 3 out of 5 members of the select board did not raise their hands. One of them specified that she wasn't entirely opposed to the new options, but she wanted more information. Back to you, Bianca.
Thank you. This next article is titled Hampstead Educator in Running for New Hampshire Teacher of the Year. In Hampstead, fourth grade teacher Heather Burkett has led her students with innovative and unconventional teaching for the past 14 years at Hampstead Central School. Now she's being recognized as a semi-finalist for the New Hampshire's 2024 Teacher of the Year. Burkett is one of 20 teachers and educators across New Hampshire up for the honor in the New Hampshire Department of Education statewide program, which acknowledges excellence in the field. She's one of 2 teachers remaining to represent Rockingham County. The Education Department announced in the most semifinalists that they've recognized in 1 year, as there were 92 nominees from. Burkett was overwhelmed and thrilled at the same time to learn that she made the next round. "I'm still speechless because it's such an honor," Burkett said. "I'm very thankful about this opportunity and the opportunity to represent the school, the district, and my colleagues in New Hampshire educators, but also personally to be acknowledged." The fourth grade teacher said that it's a reflection of the Hampstead School District and a courage for its educators to think outside the box while teaching. "We're really supported here and encouraged if we want to try something new," she said. For Burkett, that's... Excuse me. For Burkett, that started the day that she stepped foot onto Hampstead Central School. She's implemented programs like hydroponics, soilless gardening, and worm composting that have her students excited for science. She started both of those within her first 2 years at the school and has seen them evolve over time. "Kids now grow their own lettuce and then taste what they fostered in the classroom's arrow garden. Burkett even has the same family of worms for composting. They keep regenerating," she said. Burkett provides her students structure and routine every day, but also allows for reflection time for them to grow as learners. As a fourth grade teacher, she feels responsible that they are ready not only for middle school, but for the organizational and preparation tools needed to succeed in life. While she built a positive reputation in town for her teaching methods, Burkett credits a lot of her success to collaborative efforts within the school district. She's a mentor coordinator at the elementary school and additionally serves as a team member to implement the inclusion universal design of learning approach throughout the district. "It's rewarding because it's all about how the brain works," she said. "We've worked hard to get the school and the middle school acclimated with some ideas and concepts." Burkett said that she's found a teaching partner in fellow fourth grade teacher Samantha Rodriguez, who's allowed her to focus and plan fun science lessons, which is a passion of hers. "The two classrooms switched for social studies and science, and I am where I am now because of her," the teacher said. "In education, collaboration is really important because we are able to work together and we're able to do so much more for our students." The humble educator has always known that she wanted to teach in New Hampshire Hampstead School District, and it exceeded her expectations with its level of community and support of its teachers and school staff. Burkett said that "I've really grown and evolved as an educator because of working here." She will make a presentation on an education topic of her choosing this summer to the New Hampshire Department of Education in the next phase of her semifinals. The New Hampshire Teacher of the Year will be chosen in this fall. Back to you, Matt.
All right. This next story is about the debt ceiling. It's called "Default Could Have Rocked State's Economy" by Kyle Lockwood. With 2 days to spare, President Joe Biden signed a bill to suspend the nation's $31.4 trillion debt ceiling through January 1st, 2025 on Saturday. As it looked like a deal may not have been reached, Americans grew anxious on what the default on the national debt could mean. "The national debt ceiling is a fixed number of allowed money to be borrowed by the United States to cover its spending and debt. Even with the bill signed, many are concerned about the growing amount of money the country owes. Defaulting would have meant that the country would not have been able to pay its bills. Quote, most of the federal budget is devoted to mandatory spending on social insurance programs such as income security, health care, and social security, said Chris DeMar, a professor of economics at Fitchburg State University. Millions of Americans are reliant on federally secured programs like Social Security. If the nation were to default, economists believe that the first people to feel the effects would be federal employees and those reliant on federally funded programs and benefits. Many Americans rely on payments from these programs in order to afford basic necessities like food and housing, Marr said. Although Senators Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey voted no on the compromise bill struck between Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, U.S. Rep. Lori Trahan was among those to support the bill's passage. Quote, this compromise bill helped protect federally funded programs, Trahan said, discussing Social Security, Medicaid, and disability income programs. To put the impact of a default in perspective, Trahan's office said that the impact could have seen 73,000 jobs lost, put 823,000 families on Social Security at risk, and jeopardized health care benefits for 2.3 million residents, which includes Medicare, Medicaid, and Veterans Affairs, increased lifetime mortgage costs by $90,000, raised the cost of new car loans by $800, deadened retirement savings of 962,000 residents by eliminating $20,000 from the typical retirement portfolio. Not only would this have affected millions of Americans, but also communities. Local projects are often funded at the federal level, such as the Theater Block in Fitchburg. However, Trahan assured that projects such as these are not in immediate detriment and will, quote-unquote, be dealt with when with the appropriate appropriations process. Quote, while I do disagree with some of the provisions in this compromise bill, it is far from where we began, Trahan said. This deal fulfilled our obligation to the United States, which is why I vote yes. All right, back to you, Bianca.
This next article is titled, Project Could Put Bond Rating at Risk. In Andover, the town manager, Andrew Flanagan, says that funds are borrowed to pay for a new Andover High School, that it will most likely result in the town's AAA bond rating being downgraded, which could make borrowing money more expensive, potentially increasing the cost of the school itself. The cost to fund a new school or not will ultimately be up to voters. It's a reality that is before us and has to be considered. This is tricky because we don't really know what the impact will be affirmatively until we actually go borrow. Flanagan said that if the current project, which has a leaving the tax levy capacity for each other's, such as employers. Hold on, I apologize. I'm trying to find the following story. The city councilor and the Moore candidate, Melinda Barrett, was elated with the results and there's two school articles. I got a little confused. So the price tag of $480 million was funded tomorrow, and it would most likely downgrade the town's rating. So a downgrade could result in an increase to the borrowing interest rate of between 0.25% and 1%. A 0.5 increase for a project that requires borrowing $5 million over a 10-year time frame would result in an additional cost of around $138,000 to the town. The town is working to put together more data on how these changes would impact taxpayers as well as the cost of maintaining the current high school. Flanagan said that during the June 5th select board meeting that they would also be looking to other communities who have been grappling with similar issues. Shin Scully, a member of the committee for the project, added during May 31st meeting that the project does not call for significant borrowing for another 2 years, so the town does still have time to resolve the issue. Andover has also been dealing with another issue related to funding a new school. The cost of the project exceeds the amount of money that the town can borrow currently. The town can't borrow the funds at the moment because it would run into the municipality's debt limit. However, State Senator Barry Feingold said that he was confident and an amendment allowing the town to borrow the funds will be signed into law at some point in the near future. Flanagan added that the debt limit issue is not related to the concern over the town's bond rating because the rating agency looks at the total debt regardless of if it is exempted from the town's debt limit. Things excluded from the debt limit include water and sewer projects, school projects done in partnership with the Massachusetts School Building and Authority, and landfill capping. Flanagan said that Andover already has a weak debt profile because of the combination of factors including borrowing from major capital projects like the West Elementary and Shawshin School project and recent borrowing of the funds to fund unfunded liabilities. He said that Andover's total outstanding debt is just under $291 million. Proponents of the new high school project say that it is necessary to address overcrowding in the current building, which is built in the 1960s and renovated in the 80s and 90s. It is estimated that the project would result in an increase between $1,740 and $2,215 to the average annual property tax bill. Depending on interest rates, a downgrade to the town's bond rating could also impact the ultimate cost. The committee chose to recommend a new building rather than renovating the after cost estimates placed new construction as cheaper than an addition in renovation project. Community members also argued that the project would have less impact on students than a renovation. The town is currently proceeding with the project without help from the Massachusetts School Building Authority, near 10 rejections, and with building committee members citing in part that the cost of further delays. Feingold added that during the update that they have been numerous overruns with school projects around the state. Basically, every single school building project across the state that has been funded in the last 3 or 4 years is over budget, he said. Directors of Facilities Janet Nicosia gave a presentation which included information on the costs of doing nothing. Nicosia said that if nothing is done for the next 10 years, the town will need to pay between $15 and $30 million for repairs in the mechanical systems. She added that there are many HVAC and air handling units and boilers that are already beyond their useful life. Nicosia said that in order to address the overcrowding, they would need to spend about $10 million to add 10 rooms, which would be located in the parking lot. Scully said that the town has enough funds for about 3 more months of work on the design in the school. An additional $1.3 million, which would have been enough to complete the semantic design phase of the project, was originally slated to be voted on at this year's town meeting, but was pulled after the debt limit problem became clear. Mark Johnson, chair of the building committee, said that they would pursue getting those funds at a town meeting once the legislative solution to the debt limit problem is successful. The town is also currently constructing a new West Elementary School, with work on the project scheduled to be completed by 2024. Scully emphasized the ever-rising costs of construction projects. Each month that construction is delayed, it costs about $1.2 million. Back to you, Matt.
All right, this next article is from The Opinion. It's an editorial called Ban Predatory Energy Suppliers, Not the Entire Industry. History repeated itself at a hearing before the legislature's Joint Committee on Telecommunications, Utilities, and Energy on Monday, where Attorney General Andrea Campbell testified in support of legislation to protect individual utility ratepayers. Campbell championed an act relative to electric ratepayer protections, versions of which exist in both the House and the Senate, awaiting action by this joint committee. The bills would ban consumers from enrolling in competitive electric supplier contracts and punish companies trying to circumvent the law. As of now, Massachusetts is just one of 12 states that allow residents to buy electricity through competitive suppliers. The bills exempt any government body that enrolls residential retail customers in a municipal aggregation plan, as defined by MGL. These bills target suppliers that often offer introductory rates lower than traditional suppliers, like Eversource and National Grid, only to raise them significantly during the term of the contract. Quote, "We don't take this lightly. To testify for legislation is to ban an industry that is costing our residents money. It's as simple as that," Campbell stated. "We've done recent several reports on this, and the most recent talks about savings of close to $525 million where folks thought they were going to save them from this industry and frankly lost $525 million. Only Senate members were present at the hearing. The House plans to hold another hearing later this week. The AG's conclusion on this practice, apparently predatory practice, sound strikingly similar to those reached by her predecessor, Governor Maura Healey. Nearly 2 years ago, Healey and Charlie Baker's administration called for the dismantling of the competitive residential electricity market as it currently existed. A 1997 law gave Massachusetts consumers the opportunity to buy their electricity directly from a competitive supplier instead of a major utility like National Grid or Eversource or Unitil. Like Campbell's research showed, Healey's office said electricity customers in Massachusetts who switched to a competitive supplier paid $426 million more from July 2015 to June 2020 than they would have had they stayed with their utility company. The basis for Healey's remarks, a study authored by utility consultant Susan Baldwin, revealed that many consumers who switched to competitive suppliers were charged much higher rates, collectively paying $180 million more over the prior 2 years. These results reflected similar inflated charges in earlier reviews. The report also indicated that low-income households, including the gateway cities of Brockton, Fall River, Lawrence, Lowell, Lynn, and Worcester, comprised a disproportionately large share of the roughly 450,000 customers in the state's individual competitive supply market, leaving them susceptible to paying those unnecessarily high prices. Many Healey administration department heads, along with Senator Brendan Crichton and Rep. Frank Warren, pitched legislation that would ban competitive electricity suppliers from signing up new individual residential customers in Massachusetts. Campbell's words on this matter took a page from Healey's testimony as Attorney General before the very same legislative panel. "I know it is a big deal for us to call the banning of an entire industry. I don't make that call lightly, but I make the call based on the documented data, as well as anecdotes, but more importantly, the data that we have studied, showing why this industry is harming our residents. So, why hasn't this legislation already been enacted?" At that time of the Healey and Baker's pronouncements, the state rep, Jeff Roy, the co-chair of the Joint Committee on Telecommunications, Utilities, and Energy, said he'd heard about the issues before with the competitive electric supply market from various people, quote, including some of the most responsible competitive suppliers who take exception to what they see happening out in this industry, too. And at least one related industry trade group, the Retail Energy Supply Association, had previously taken issues with Healey's claims. According to published reports, it maintained that Massachusetts residents could save money by using a retail energy supplier, with the potential for consumers to collectively pocket hundreds of millions over time. Lumping ostensibly reputable energy suppliers with the unscrupulous ones has probably given lawmakers pause. While many individual companies may prey on uninformed, low-income populations, many other suppliers, including green alternatives, specifically spell out the cost of acquiring electricity, usually at a higher price than other options. Legislation that pulls the plug on problematic electricity suppliers, rather than eliminating an entire industry, would likely gain the support required to pass in both the House and the Senate. All right, back to you, Bianca.
The sixth article is titled, "Why is it so smoky outside? Canada wildfires lead to air quality alerts in northeastern U.S. Intense Canadian wildfires are blanketing the northeastern U.S. in a dystopian haze, turning the air acrid, the sky yellowish-gray, and prompting warnings for vulnerable populations to stay inside. The effects of hundreds of wildfires burning across the western provinces of Quebec could be felt as far away as New York City and New England, blotting out skylines and irritating throats. U.S. authorities issued air quality alerts. Hazy conditions and smoke from the wildfires were reported across the Great Lakes and region from Cleveland to Buffalo. A smoky haze that hung over New York City much of the day Tuesday, thickening into the late afternoon, obscuring views of New Jersey across the Hudson River and making the setting sun look like a reddish orb in the Philadelphia area. Dusk brought more of a lavender haze. Sal and Lily Murphy of Brooklyn likened the burning scent to a campfire. They said that they could even smell the smoke indoors. In the Manhattan restaurant, they then walked outside and saw the sky looked like it was about to storm. but it was rainless. Lily wore a mask for protection. "It's a little scary, Sal," Murphy said. "Smoke from the fires have wafted through northeast U.S. states for weeks now, but it only recently has been noticeable in most places." New York Governor Kathy Hochul said that Tuesday's hazy skies were hard to miss, and New York City Mayor Eric Adams encouraged residents to limit outdoor activities to the absolute necessities. Here's a closer look at what's happening and some suggested precautions for dealing with the haze. So what's happening? Smoke from Canada's wildfires have been moving into the United States since last month. The most recent fires near Quebec have been burning for at least several days. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency said the hazy skies, reduced visibility, and outdoor burning wood are most likely that the smoke will linger for a few days in the northern states. It's not unusual for us to get fire smoke in our area. It's very typical in terms of the Northwest Canada, said Darren Austin, a meteorologist, senior air quality specialist with the Rhode Island Department of Environmental Management. But usually the smoke has been aloft and hasn't affected people's health, he said. The Quebec area fires are big and relatively close, about 500 to 600 miles, roughly 800 to 970 kilometers, away from Rhode Island, and they followed the wildfires in Nova Scotia, which resulted in short-lived air quality alert on May 30th. Jay Engel, a National Weather Service meteorologist based in Upton, Long Island, said that the wind trajectory that allowed smoke and hazy conditions to be seen in New York City area would continue in the next few days. Of course, he said that the main driver of conditions is the fires themselves. As they diminish, the haze would too. What's the biggest concern? Air quality alerts are triggered by a number of factors, including the detection of fine particle pollution, known as PM2.5, which can irritate the lungs. We have defenses in our upper airway to trap larger particles and prevent them from getting into our lungs. These are sort of the right size to get past those defenses, though, said Dr. David Hill, a pulmonologist. When those particles get down into the respiratory space, they can cause the body to have an inflammatory reaction to them. Trent Ford, the state climatologist in Illinois, said that the atmospheric conditions in the upper Midwest creating dry, warm weather made it possible for small particles to travel hundreds of miles from the Canadian wildfires and linger for days. It's a good example of how complex the climate system is, but also how connected it is. Back to you, Matt.
All right. This next story is from the sports section. It said, Eichel, two wins away from a Stanley Cup crown. A North Chelmsford native powering Las Vegas with 22 points. Matthew Tkachuk lined up with Jack Eichel and leveled him with the Thunder's open ice hit that sent him to the ice. Eichel quickly staved off and retreated to the locker room for more than a few moments, putting a scare into the Vegas Golden Knights late into the second period of Game 2 of the Stanley Cup Final. Instead of his night being over, Eichel returned for the third period and set up the fifth goal of 7 in a rout of the Florida Panthers that put Vegas up 2-0 in the best-of-seven series and two wins away from championship. Eichel, a North Chelmsford native, leads the NHL playoffs with 16 assists and is tied for second in scoring with 22 points. The hit debated around the hockey world was quickly determined by all involved to be clean, and Eichel's bounce back to play another important role in this playoff only further exemplified a team mantra that it hurts to win. Players, after checking in with Eichel to make sure at intermission that he was okay, repeated that phrase over and over. "It's definitely a big collision," Eichel said. "It's a physical game. You're going to get hit sometimes, you just kind of move on." Eichel refused to complain about the hit and even took responsibility for putting himself in that position. "Got to be aware of it, you know? You got to keep your head up." That kind of hit used to be commonplace in the NHL, but has faded with the evolution of players towards skill and away from potentially brutal contact. Tkachuk, the Panthers' leading scorer this postseason and their emotional leader, is not afraid to throw his body around in order to make a difference and carries with him an old-school mentality about players protecting themselves. "Doesn't matter who you are, shouldn't be going through the middle with your head down. You're going to get hit. I mean, I would get hit too if I had my head down in the middle. It's nothing. It's not a big deal. He's a really good player, and good players can get hit too." The hit itself was made worse by Eichel losing his footing. A toe picked a bit seconds before contact. He landed awkwardly and grimaced while skating off. Eichel later conceded he got the wind knocked out of him, but it appeared worse in real time. "You don't want to see a guy like Jack go down," teammate William Currier said. "He looked bad out there, to be honest." Eichel didn't think it was bad enough to arrive on the ice and wait for medical attention when he could skate off and begin the process of collecting himself. When did he know for sure he was okay? It didn't take long. I just came into the locker room and regrouped. I got my wits about me and realized I was fine. Vegas led 4-0 at the time after chasing Florida goaltender Sergei Bobrovsky, and Eichel sitting out for precautionary reasons would not have been all that unusual. But after coach Bruce Cassidy confirmed everything was all right, Eichel was back on the bench at the start of the third, providing a boost by his mere presence. Not only does it give us juice, but sometimes it can take away juice from the other team if they see a good guy come back. It was good for the group. On Eichel's first shift back, he won a puck battle and fed the puck to Jonathan Marchessault for his second goal of the game, and the Golden Knights' fifth. That's the resiliency we have in that locker room, Marchessault said. It starts with your top guys and goes right through the lineup. The announcement of Eichel's assist drew a louder-than-usual cheer from the crowd of 18,561. That meant a lot to Eichel, who appreciated teammates making sure he was good to go. Everyone's taken a couple hits in their career. This is a physical game we play, so it's all part of it. Not letting it derail his and the Knights' title might make the hit and Eichel's response part of franchise lore if they can finish off Florida and hoist the cup for the first time in the franchise's brief six-year history. Already, teammates called Eichel strong and, quote-unquote, a warrior. His coach was most proud of Eichel boasting the toughness of a hockey player willing to take a hit and pop right up and continue contributing. That's hockey, Cassidy said. It's okay to get hit in June. This is part of the journey. It hurts to win, and it's not supposed to be easy. Good for him. All right, back to you, Bianca.
We're going to take about 15-minute break, and we'll be back for the second half of the show. Thank you.
Mostly cloudy temperatures in the mid-60s. The sun rose this morning at 5:08, setting at 8:19 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center. Join the Talking Information Center to celebrate 45 years of service here on the South Shore at the 1620 Winery in Plymouth on Thursday, June 8th. The Talking Information Center is a nonprofit organization on the South Shore, providing newspapers, magazines, and best-selling books read by volunteers to the print-impaired population of Massachusetts. The evening features great food, a live and silent auction, dancing, and music provided by the band Total Strangers.
Give me that loving. Give me some itty bitty loving.
For more information on the Talking Information Center 45th Anniversary Celebration, log on to ticnetwork.org or text TICBASH to 76278. That's the Talking Information Center 45th Anniversary Celebration, Thursday, June 8th, at the 1620 Winery at Cordage Park in Plymouth. We hope to see you there.
This is Nnamdi Asamoah. I play football for the Philadelphia Eagles, but what I do off the field with United Way might be more important. I'm a volunteer tutor and mentor. Why? Because over a million kids a year drop out of school, and that's not okay. It takes 12 years to create a graduate, but it takes about the same time to create a dropout. And the difference between a child becoming one or the other could be me, or it could be you. Studies show that if we get to these kids earlier, their chances are better, and kids who read well by third grade are more likely to graduate. So join me in United Way. Suit up and take the pledge. Become a volunteer reader, tutor, or mentor, because when a child succeeds, we all succeed. Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Take the pledge at unitedway.org. Brought to you by United Way, the Ad Council, and the National Football League.
Newton's Carroll Center for the Blind, one of the largest vision rehabilitation agencies in the nation, will host its 11th annual Walk for Independence on Saturday, June 3rd, from 8 a.m. to noon. It's a family-friendly event, bringing together both sighted and visually impaired individuals to support the nonprofit organization's mission. Walkers can choose either a 1, 2, or 3 mile stroll around the Mount Ida campus of UMass Amherst, located at 100 Carlson Avenue in Newton, and then stay for complimentary food, music, accessible games, and fun giveaways. Guide dogs and family pets on leashes are welcome. Individuals and teams can register at www.carol.org/walk. That's www.carol.org/walk.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Littleboro, WRRS Littleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLP FL, WDJ. Framingham.
Coming up next from the Talking Information Center is the reading of the Washington Post. Please stay tuned to hear selected articles from this newspaper.
This is Ann reading from the Washington Post on Wednesday, June 7th. Damage to Russian-held hydroelectric plant floods South Ukraine battlefield by Samantha Schmidt, Isabel Koshy, Natalia Abakumova, and Seji Korolchuk. A critical dam in southern Ukraine was heavily damaged after a reported explosion early Tuesday, sending water gushing toward dozens of communities, including some occupied by Russia, and prompting officials to evacuate thousands of people at risk of catastrophic flooding. Russia seized the dam, which is part of the Kachkovka hydroelectric power plant, on the first day of its invasion in February 2022 because of its crucial role in supplying fresh water to Crimea, the Ukrainian peninsula that Russia illegally annexed in 2014. It was not clear who was responsible for the damage, which occurred as Kyiv stepped up offensive operations on the Eastern Front as part of what is expected to be a major counterattack over the coming weeks. Ukraine and Russia quickly traded blame for the blast. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of blowing up the hydroelectric power plant from inside. The disaster at the Kachkovka hydroelectric power plant caused by Russian terrorists will not stop Ukraine and Ukrainians, Zelensky said in his evening address, posted as a video to social media. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov claimed that the damage was a deliberate sabotage by the Ukrainian side, in part to deprive Crimea of water. Apparently, this sabotage is related to the fact that the Ukrainian armed forces, having started the offensive 2 days ago, are not achieving their goals now, Peskov said Tuesday during his daily conference call with reporters. U.S. officials had not made a determination about who or what caused it, a White House spokesman said Tuesday. We are working with the Ukrainians to gather more information, but we cannot say conclusively what happened at this point, National Security Council spokesman John Kirby told reporters at the White House. As floodwaters continue to rise, Ukrainian authorities said 40,000 people should be evacuated from the Kherson region. By Tuesday afternoon, Ukraine's Interior Ministry said about 1,300 people had been evacuated. The dueling accusations by Kyiv and Moscow set off intense speculation about which side might have more to gain by flooding the battlefield in the south, as well as deep consternation about the extent of environmental and economic damage. The cause of the dam's breach remained unclear. On one occasion, as Ukrainian forces plotted a counteroffensive in the Kherson region, they conducted a test strike using an American-provided HIMARS rocket launcher to puncture three holes in one of the floodgates of the Kachkovka Dam. Major General Andrei Kovalchuk, who led the Kherson offensive, told the Washington Post late last year that the goal was to see if the water level of the Dnieper River could be raised enough to stymie Russian crossings, but not flood nearby villages. The test was a success, Kovalchuk said, but commanders decided to hold off on such an operation. Tuesday's dramatic events in the south came amid an escalation in Ukrainian combat activity, including a series of offensive operations on the eastern front, signaling that Kyiv's forces may have launched the preliminary phases of their long-awaited counteroffensive. Russia claimed Tuesday that it had repelled a long-promised offensive mounted by Ukrainian troops at a dozen points on the front line over the previous 3 days. Ukraine denied that assertion. Attempts to attack were thwarted. The enemy was stopped, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said. Kyiv has previously dismissed Russian claims that its army has repelled Ukrainian attacks as disinformation aimed at undermining the assault. Leaders in Kyiv have cautioned repeatedly in recent days that no single action would mark the start of the counterattack, nor would it be announced. It remained to be seen how the flooding would affect troop movements. In an interview with the Post, Ihor Sirota, general director of Ukraine's state hydroelectric company, Erkahydroenergo, said the dam was irreparable and all the water in the Kharkovka reservoir could spill out within the next 4 days. Sirota also warned of environmental damage. About 450 tons of oil had begun seeping from the station into the river, he said. It is heading toward Kherson in the Black Sea, he said. This will be an ecological catastrophe. Erkhydroenergo, in a statement on Telegram, said the hydroelectric plant was completely destroyed as a result of an explosion inside the engine room. Aerial videos showed heavy structural damage to the dam, which appeared to be missing sections measuring hundreds of feet. Natalia Hymeniuk, a spokeswoman for the Ukrainian military Southern Command, said in a radio interview that the dam was not completely destroyed, but sustained serious damage. She accused the Russians of targeting the dam to stop Ukraine's expected counteroffensive. Andriy Pilinskaya, a captain in Ukraine's armed forces, now based in the south, accused the Russians of trying to destroy positions that Ukrainians could use as a springboards for attack. By flooding the area, Russians could prevent Ukrainians from moving south by land along the Dnieper's east bank in a bid to oust the Russian from parts of Kherson they control. But Pilinskaya argued that Ukrainian-controlled West Bank is higher in elevation than the East, and that Russia's military positions are simply flooded and had to be evacuated. Russian units there, Pilinskaya said, were not aware of this whole situation. They're just shocked. Michael Kaufman, a Russian military analyst at the Washington-based Center for A New American Security, said he did not expect the dam breach to have a big impact on Ukraine's offensive. The likelihood of a Ukrainian offensive operation across the river south of the dam was quite low, he said. The flood washes away Russian defenses there, but makes a river crossing now exceedingly more difficult, Kaufman said. In the Russian-occupied city of Novokharkovka, adjacent to the dam, water levels were several feet high in front of the city council building, according to video published by Ukraine's public broadcaster. Suspilny swans could be seen in the water. The Ukrainian former mayor, Novokharkovka, Vladimir Kovalenko, said in an interview that a zoo, a recreation area, and sports complex were flooded within hours. While he was not in the Russia-occupied city, Kovalenko said he spoke to residents through encrypted channels. At the submerged zoo, home to 260 animals, only the ducks and swans could be saved, according to U-Animals, Ukraine's largest animal charity, which said it spoke with the zoo's management. In the low-lying city located on the east bank of the Dnieper, the water in some places had overflowed by about 1,600 feet from the normal shoreline. Kovalenko said he feared it would reach 2 to 3 story homes and cottages in an old part of the city. At any moment, the water may have reached these houses, he said. The dam sits at the end of the Dnieper River in Ukraine's southern Kherson region. Its reservoir stores roughly the same amount of water as the Great Salt Lake in Utah. Russian occupying forces pushed the Ukrainian workers out of the plant, created a military base at the site, and in October cut it off from Ukraine's electrical grid. The fast-rising water levels threatens residents from northern Kherson, where the dam is located, down to the Black Sea. The reservoir also supplies water through canals to occupied Crimea and to the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Russian-controlled Enerhoda. Ukraine's atomic energy authorities said the plant so far has not been affected by the dam breach. Ukrainian officials blamed Russia. This is a heinous war crime, Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba tweeted. Interior Minister Ihor Klimenko warned residents that the flood could wash up Russian mines. Vladimir Leontiev, the Russian-installed mayor of occupied Nova Kakhovka, said water levels have risen by 16 feet, flooding several downstream settlements. Those in the immediate vicinity of the water were being moved to dry places, he said, but large-scale evacuations were not expected. The situation is under control, Leontiev said. The Kharkovka hydroelectric power plant was built in such a way as to be able to withstand a nuclear strike. He said that the upper part of the plant was destroyed, but that the dam was only partially damaged. The Russian-installed authorities of the Kherson region later announced...
Hello, everyone. We are back. You're listening to the local station for the Lions Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of Massachusetts Auto Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information located in Lowell, Mass. We read local news, editorials, features, stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff at the local station for the Lions. This is Bianca and Matt, and I will be reading from the Eagle Tribune and Lowell Sun. This year, Lab is celebrating 100 years of service to the blind and visually impaired community. We would like to thank our Centennial sponsors, Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation and the Cummings Foundation for their support. I'm continuing with the Eagle Tribune and reading from the Dear Abby column. This is titled, Wife's Ability to Trust Her Husband Takes a Hit. Dear Abby, my husband and I are in our early 70s, and we have been married for 7 years. I was celibate before we met and thrilled to have a partner I respected and was attracted to. Our sex life seemed normal and exciting, with lots of kisses, hugs throughout the day. Recently, I caught him on his phone sex calling, and then I discovered that he visits sex chat rooms. I'm devastated. I feel betrayed and angry that my trust has been violated. After several attempts to lie, he finally admitted the truth and said that it was a recent thing, which is even more insulting. My therapist says that men don't suddenly take up phone sex and pornography in their 70s. When I shared that with my husband, he revealed that it wasn't as often in the past. He swears that he loves me and will get help, but I can't imagine how I could trust him again. He doesn't seem to want to talk about it any further, other than taking some online classes dealing with porn addiction. Our relationship has always been cordial and friendly, and that continues, though I'm no longer willing to have sex at this time. My impulse is to bolt. I'm too old to deal with this nonsense, and I just want to live the rest of our lives in peace. What do you think? Signed, Throne in Kansas. Dear Throne, please ignore your impulse to bolt. When you started your letter, you started with that you had a good marriage to a man who respected and attracted you, who you respected and you were attracted to, with the bonus of kisses and hugs throughout the day. Your husband isn't having physical contact with anyone on the hotline. If your therapist hasn't told you, many thousands of individuals of both sexes consider porn to be erotic and helpful, and many couples use it to enhance their sex lives. Rather than sacrifice what has been a successful marriage, you and your husband would be better off scheduling some appointments with a marriage and family therapist, and possibly one who specializes in sex therapy, to help overcome your emotional issue on this high personal subject. Dear Abby, my former husband of 28 years cheated on me for the last 15 years of our marriage. For the last 6 years, I have been in a healthy and happy relationship. I went to counseling for 5 years, and per the counselor, I don't need to go anymore. My 36-year-old daughter wants me to attend family gatherings with my ex and his wife, his third mistress. I have gone to 2 of them, but I really have no desire to do it any longer. My daughter is telling me that I still have issues and that I need to heal, and has been lecturing me about this for years. May I sacrifice my feelings for her? Signed, Clear Break in New England. Dear Clean Break, No, you have suffered enough. I see no reason why you must continue to expose yourself to the company of those two. Those two people you neither like nor respect. If your daughter cannot accept this, then perhaps she needs counseling to understand it. Dear Abby is written by Aunt Abigail Van Buren, also known as Janine Phillips, and was founded by her mother, Pauline Phillips. To contact Dear Abby, you can go to www.dearabby.com or the P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California. Okay, back to you, Matt.
All right, this story is from the Oil Sun in the sports section. This is titled, Hail Caesar, Joseph Fuels Lowell. The Red Raiders faced some adversity, but oust Lincoln Sudbury. Caesar Joseph helped rally the troops as the second-seeded Lowell High boys volleyball team defeated number 18, Lincoln Sudbury, 3-1 in the in the second round of the MIAA Division I state tournament. A sophomore sharpshooter, Joseph, was deadly in front of the Lowell net, registering a team-high 19 kills, including some pivotal crunch-time spikes during the decisive fourth and final set to seal the deal. They came out strong at the beginning of the match, said Joseph, but we managed to push further. That was it. We kept going. In a back-and-forth battle, Lowell, with a record of 21-1, never surrendered its lead, beating the Warriors in four tight-fisted games, 25-15, 17-25, 25-19, and 25-21. The Red Raiders advanced to play number 7, Newton North, or number 10, Winchester, in third-round action. It feels good, said Cody Fitzpatrick, who added 16 kills in the decision. They put a little pressure on us, but in the end, we came out with the win. According to Lowell coach Paul McCarthy, a garrison finish such as this can go a long way as his young team continues to build its confidence as a tourney contender. This is great, said McCarthy. The kids came in together, and once again, you saw their youth, but they tightened up a little bit under that pressure. I thought it was a good experience for them. They stepped it up after a rough start or two, but that's the youth in them. They kept going. That's what they do. The Red Raiders had work to do. Had to work out the kinks initially, falling into a 4-0 funk in its first set before finding its groove. They regained momentum off the stellar play of Fitzpatrick and Joseph. Junior Aiden Wong was also a factor, reeling off 8 kills and 2 blocks. Junior Tyrell Lout kept the offense flowing, dishing out a game-high 52 assists. Tyrell is one of the best setters in the state, said McCarthy. Lincoln Sudbury quickly regrouped in the second set, embarking on a 6-point swing off the heady play of senior captains Hogan Fletcher and Oscar Kloppenbach. Sophomore Tim Kearney added to the momentum shift as the visitors took the second game 25-17. Lowell senior Eddie Jacha, 6 kills and 6 blocks, helped his team find its mojo in a shifting third set, with Walter Palacio also chipping in, putting the Warriors on the ropes. Lowell refused to let up in the fourth set, Joseph and Fitzpatrick trading off thunderous spikes to put the match away. He said, I thought we made some good adjustments and were starting to block their fast-run offense, Lincoln Sudbury's coach, Elizabeth McCormick. They ran a set of combination plays. They were able to shut some of that down, but they had some good firepower from all three positions and were scoring points. They were making some mistakes, but we weren't able to quite get everything rolling the way we needed to. According to Lowell Jr. Eric Mann, Lincoln Sudbury helped his team take it to the next level. They just forced us to work harder, said Yen. Now we know that we can't let up on teams at all. You've got to play hard every game. We continue to play as a family, said Yatra. That's what we do. Call it family culture, team culture. We keep playing even when we're down. We've got to keep pushing. I really think it came down to our depth, said McCarthy. If someone's hurting, someone else steps up. I think Caesar stepped up big, Aiden stepped up big, and Cody's Cody. I'm just happy for the kids. Let's keep the ride going. Alright, back to you, Bianca.
This next article is titled Commencement Day. So, class of 2023 graduates from Andover High. The Andover High School senior class graduated on Monday evening at the Sangha Center of UMass Lowell. A number of representatives from the school district attended the ceremony, including Superintendent Magda Parvi. The graduation choir performed Lift Every Voice and Sing, America, I Was Here, and the Star Spangled Banner. The valedictorian is Rishi Gujar, and the salutatorian is Vincent Zhou. Both were members of the Andover Robotics Club and are distinguished scholars. Zhou is also a member of the National Honor Society and received a Massachusetts Seal of Biliteracy. Remarks were given by Anthony Morgante and Isabel Galano, Morgante is a member of the Tri Music Society, and Galanto is a member of the National Honor Society. The class essayist was Gabriela Arawak, who received the endorsement of Global Engagement. School committee members also participated in what was the school's 163rd commencement ceremony. Okay, back to you now.
All right. Sorry, let me find where the story actually starts. All right. So, this next story is called Normandy Marks D-Day's 79th Anniversary Honors Vets. On Omaha Beach, France, an overwhelming sound of gunfire and men's screams. That's how World War II veteran Marie Scott described D-Day, as Tuesday's ceremonies got underway in honor of those who fought for freedom in the largest naval, air, and land operation in history. This year's tribute to the young soldiers who died in Normandy also reminds veterans, officials, and visitors of what Ukraine faces today. On Tuesday, the whistling sound of the wind accompanied many reenactment visitors who came to Omaha Beach to mark the 79th anniversary of the assault that led to the liberation of France and Western Europe from Nazi control. Some brought bunches of flowers, others waved American flags. Scott loved it all through her ears. She was just 17 when she was posted as communication operator in Portsmouth, England. Her job was to pass messages between men on the ground and General Dwight D. Eisenhower and senior officials who were supervising the operation. Quote, I was in the war. I could hear gunfire, machine guns, bombing, aircraft, men screaming, shouting, giving orders, she recalled. After a few minutes of horror, I realized what was happening, and I thought, well, you know, there's no time for horror. You've got a job to do, so get on with it, which is what I did. Now about to turn 97, Scott said D-Day was a pivotal point in her life. As a non-combatant, I was still in the war. I realized the enormity of war. People were dying in that moment. Scott said that she was disgusted that another war was now raging on the European continent following Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. For me, war should only be undertaken if it's absolutely necessary. There's no other way of solving the problem. It's an atrocity. That's how I feel, she said. British veteran Mervyn Kirsch, who landed on D-Day on Gold Beach, said Western allies should send maximum military aid to Ukraine. Quote, the only way to stay free is to be strong. Kirsch added with a sense of humor, I'm still in the reserve. I'm waiting to go to Ukraine now. Next job. On Tuesday, a ceremony took place at the American Cemetery in Côte-sur-Mer, overlooking Omaha Beach, which is home to the graves of 9,386 U.S. soldiers, most of whom lost their lives in the D-Day landings and ensuing operations. On the walls of the missing are the inscribed set of 1,557 names. Some of those names have since been recovered and identified. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, speaking in front of more than 40 World War II veterans and a crowd of visitors, said, it is our duty to defend the principles for which the Allies fought. We seek a world where civilians are safe from the ravages of war, and sovereignty and territorial integrity are to be respected. He paid tribute to, quote, brave young men and women from Ukraine who are learning how to fight for their lives in their country. Today, I am more determined than ever to stand by them for as long as it takes. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Jim Mark Milley also took part in the American Cemetery commemoration. The Normandy celebrations were a chance for Milley to linger with troops who consider him one of their own as he winds down his own four-decade military career. The chairman held commands in both the 82nd Airborne Division and the 101st Airborne Division, and the Normandy fields, towns, and causeways are these divisions' hallowed ground. For me, being among soldiers is home, he said. Milley begins his 44th year of military service on June 10th. He is scheduled to retire at the end of September as his term as chairman ends. Hundreds of current soldiers from both units were there, some on leave with beers in hand, some jumping out of aircraft as their predecessors did 97 years before. This was Milley's last Normandy visit as their top commander, and as he walked through St. Mary Bruce, known to be as the first town liberated from Nazi occupation. He attended commemorative football games or spoke at ceremonies. It felt like the general stopped to talk to and give a commemorative coin to every last one of them. An international ceremony was later scheduled at the British Normandy Memorial and in the presence of officials from Germany and the nine principal Allied nations, Belgium, Canada, Denmark, France, the Netherlands, Poland, Norway, the United Kingdom, and the United States. French Minister of Armed Forces Sebastien Lecornu and UK Defense Secretary Ben Wallace were expected to attend. In a separate event, French President Emmanuel Macron attended a ceremony in the presence of 100-year-old Léon Gauthier, the last surviving member of the Kfir Commando, an elite French unit which was among the first waves to land in Normandy. All right, Bianca, back to you.
This next article is former governor from New Jersey, Chris Christie, launches 2024 presidential bid. In Manchester, New Hampshire, former New Jersey governor Chris Christie wasted no time getting going after Donald Trump while launching his presidential campaign on Tuesday, calling the former president and current Republican primary frontrunner a lonely, self-consumed, self-observing, self-serving mirror hog, and arguing that he's the only one who can stop him. Christie began his run with a town hall in New Hampshire. The former governor and federal prosecutor ran for president and lost to Trump in 2016 and went on to become a close off-and-on advisor before breaking the former president over his refusal to accept the results of the 2020 election. Now that Trump is trying again for the White House, Christie's out to do everything in his power to deny him. After criticizing other Republican Party primary rivals for being afraid to directly challenge Trump, Christie made it clear that he had no such concerns. The person I am talking about, who is obsessed with the mirror, who never admits a mistake, who never admits a fault, who always finds someone else and something else to blame for whatever goes wrong, but finds every reason to take credit for anything that goes right, is Donald Trump, he told a small, mostly friendly crowd at the St. Anselm College. A lonely, self-consumed, self-serving mirror hog is not a leader, Christie said, saying Trump made us smaller by dividing us even further and pitting us against one another. But also he said that Joe Biden is doing the same thing just on the other side. He noted that he'd known Biden for decades and said that the president is out of his depth because he's not the guy he used to be, referencing the 80-year-old Biden's advanced age. But Christie's chief target was Trump. There's a big argument in our country right now about whether character matters, and we have leaders who have shown us over and over again that not only are they devoid of character, but they don't care, Christie said. We can't dismiss the question of character anymore. Everybody, if we do, we get what we deserve, and we will have it our own way. Christie enters a growing primary field that already includes Trump, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, former United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley, and U.S. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. Former U.S. President, Vice President Mike Pence will be formally launching his own campaign in Iowa on Wednesday. During his time as governor, Christie established a reputation as a fighter with a knack for creating viral moments of confrontation. But he faces an uphill battle to the nomination in a party that remains closely aligned with the former president. Despite Trump's re-election loss in 2020 and Republicans' poorer than expected showing in the 2022 midterm elections, Christie argues that unless top Republicans dare confront Trump, there will be a repeat of the 2016 GOP primary when Trump rolled over a host of alternatives with more political experience who split the support of voters opposing him. Back to you, Matt.
All right. This next story is called Heading to the Hague. This is by Rick Sobey. It's about a Boston lawyer appointed as a lead prosecutor. A Boston lawyer who is one of the final names for being considered for the U.S. attorney role in Massachusetts before Rachel Rollins was ultimately picked and later resigned in disgrace, has been appointed as the top prosecutor at The Hague for the Kosovo War Crimes Tribunal. Kim West, a partner at Ashcroft Law Firm in Boston, was recently selected as a specialist prosecutor for the Kosovo Specialist Chambers and the Specialist Prosecutor's Office in The Hague in the Netherlands. West was one of the highest-profile local lawyers who were being looked at as the replacement for Andrew Lowen to lead the Bay State U.S. Attorney's Office. Lowens, the Suffolk County District Attorney at the time, was later picked as U.S. Attorney, and she recently resigned following bombshell investigative reports from two federal watchdog agencies. Instead of the experienced and accomplished West running the Massachusetts U.S. Attorney's Office, she's now heading to the European Union-backed court. Quote, I'm extremely grateful to the European Union for selecting me in this position, West said in a statement. My colleagues at the Ashcroft Law Firm know that my passion has long been centered around international investigations. They recognize that this is the lifetime of the opportunity of a lifetime and have all been very supportive. This new role allows me to continue working with victims, witnesses, and the international community to ensure that perpetrators of war crimes are brought to justice. West added, she began her legal career as an assistant district attorney in Plymouth County. Then, after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, she joined the Anti-Terrorism and National Security Unit at the Massachusetts U.S. Attorney's Office. Later, she served for 5 years as a trial attorney at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague, where she prosecuted Radovan Karadzic, who was found guilty of directing the genocide of more than 7,000 Bosnian Muslims in the worst massacre on European soil since the Holocaust. Then, chief of the Criminal Bureau for the Attorney General's Office in Massachusetts, West supervised a team of more than 120 professionals responsible for investigating and prosecuting a range of financial, fraud, corruption, narcotics, gaming, human trafficking, and other offenses. West at Ashcroft Law Firm is focused primarily on white-collar cases, primarily representing international clients. We are immensely proud of her achievements and grateful for the contributions she has made to our firm, said Michael Sullivan, managing partner of Ashcroft Law Firm's Boston office. People from around the world have sought her help because of her empathy, commitment to international justice, and accountability. Those same characteristics will guide her in her new position. Former U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft, the firm's founder and chairman, said of West, her appointment to the European Union-backed court is not at all surprising because her career has been defined by a dedication to justice on a global scale. We are sad to be losing Kim as our colleague, but by selecting her for this key position, the international community has chosen the ideal steward to oversee the important responsibility of investigating war crimes in Kosovo. All right, Bianca, back to you.
This next article is titled Derry Library Hosts Fan Con on Saturday. In Derry, the Derry Public Library will hold its Fan Con event, for formerly known as Comic Con, on Saturday, June 17th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the library, 64 East Broadway, number 2414. Anime, superheroes, Star Wars, and other gaming characters are welcome. There will be cosplay, trivia, gaming prizes, and more. For more information, you could call 603-432-6140. The Center of Life Management to welcome known meteorologists. In Atkinson, a prominent, nationally known meteorologist will be the keynote speaker when the Center of the Life Management in Derry holds a fundraiser on Thursday, June 8th at the Atkinson Resort and Country Club at 85 Country Club Drive. Meteorologist, author, and storyteller Ginger Z of ABC News and Good Morning America is the guest speaker and will share her own struggles with anorexia, abusive relationships, and depression. The Center for Life Management has been providing comprehensive behavioral and mental health care to the region for more than 50 years, and offering help for those of all ages. Tickets are $100 per person and available at Ginger Z Behind the Smile. com. Tables and sponsorships are available, and most sponsorships include access to private welcome reception with Z before the event. For more information, please contact Melissa Ballard Sullivan at 603-956-070 or her email at mballardsullivan@clmnh.org. New Hampshire in a minute. Located 2 miles from the center of Derry, register for the Derby that day from 9:30 to 10 a.m. with fishing to follow at 10 a.m. Prizes will be awarded starting at 12 p.m. The Derby will be held rain or shine and is for the youth 15 years old and under. The event is sponsored by the Beaver Lake Improvement Association. Benefit yard sale to take place in Kingston. Kingston. The Friends of Kingston Open Space will conduct an annual benefit yard sale on Saturday, June 17th, starting at 7:30 a.m. at 50 Rock Rimmon Road. Proceeds from the yard sale are used to help preserve open space. Anyone interested in donating items can call 603-548-7448 or 603-642-8744 to coordinate delivery times. Homegrown Farm and and artisan's market is back. So in Derry Homegrown Farm and Artisan Market opens up on the sixth season of June 7th at 1 West Broadway. It will run every Wednesday for 18 weeks through September. There's plenty of free parking available on the street and at two nearby municipal lots. Patrons can expect to be able to purchase ingredients for a complete meal and buy some grab-and-go foods as well. This year's selection will include fresh seafood, meats, eggs, produce, cheese, artisanal breads, pastries, and more. There will also be live music, children's activities, and artist demonstrations. For more information, you can visit DerryHomegrown.org or email info@DerryHomegrown.org or call 603-497-5918. Back to you, Matt.
I've also got a few stories from the 5-minute read section. First is a DAISY Award recipient. Alexandra Gray, a pediatric nurse at Lowell Community Health Center, was honored by her colleagues with the DAISY Award for Extraordinary Nurses, presented during National Nurses Week in May. Gray, who joined the LCHC in 2021, is the center's second annual DAISY Award recipient. Quote, Alex truly exemplifies the vision and mission of the DAISY Awards, CEO Elizabeth Hale said. She is a shining example of nurses at its best, providing extraordinary, compassionate, and skillful care for our community's pediatric patients as she supports, mentors, and uplifts her colleagues. Founded in 1970, Lowell Community Health Center serves as the family doctor for nearly half of Lowell's population. Its staff and programs provide caring, quality, and culturally appropriate health services to the people of Greater Lowell, regardless of their financial status. For more information, you can visit lchealth.org. Next is Portugal flag raising. In addition to the flags customarily flown at JFK Plaza, the city custom commemorates many flags from different countries during the year. On Saturday, June 10th at 5 p.m., the public is invited to a flag raising for Portugal. The outdoor event is held in front of City Hall at 375 Merrimack Street. For a list of flag raising dates, you can visit bit.ly/3L4Y4CC. To schedule a flag raising ceremony, submit an application to the Office of Cultural Affairs and Special Events 3 to 4 weeks prior to the date of the flag raising. For more information, you can call 978-674-1482 or email rdei@lowellma.gov. Next is a Democrats caucus in Billerica. Democrats in Billerica are holding a virtual 2023 convention caucus on Saturday, June 10th at 10 a.m. to elect 19 delegates and 4 alternates to the 2023 Massachusetts Democratic Agenda and Action Convention. The in-person convention will be held at September 23rd, which is a Saturday, at the Saunders Center in Lowell. To register, you can go to bit.ly/42skprd. And for more information, you can email billericadtc@billericademocrats@gmail.com. The caucus is open to all registered and pre-registered Democrats in Billerica. Pre-registered Democrats are those who are 16 years or older by May 23rd. Delegates will be divided equally by gender identity. Youth, underrepresented minorities, and people with disabilities who are not elected as delegates or alternates may apply to be add-on delegates. For more information, go to massdems.org. Second last is a municipal open house in Chelmsford. The Chelmsford Select Board hosts a municipal open house on Monday, June 12th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Chelmsford Public Library on 25 Boston Road. Speak one-on-one with members of the Select Board and representatives from various town departments and committees. The Board is soliciting feedback from residents on services and the town's mission and events. Light refreshments will be provided. Finally is a MassDOT webinar on the bridge project. The Massachusetts Department of Transportation will host a virtual design hearing for the project to replace the Gorham Street Bridge and Westford Street Bridge, which carry vehicles over Interstate 495 in Chelmsford. The project will be discussed Wednesday, June 14th at 6 p.m. via Zoom. For information on this project, visit bit.ly/3IUARDH, or to register, go to bit.ly/45RHKGC. All right, Bianca, back to you.
This next article is from the sports section, and it is titled Too Close for Comfort. Knights barely get past Central in tourney opener, so North Andover, on paper, North Andover was supposed to win. The Knights came in as the higher seed. A more experienced team with an outstanding goalie and had defeated Central Catholic twice already this season by a combined score of 33-14. By the end of the third quarter, the potential upset alert had sounded as Central, down 6-1 at halftime, sliced the margin to just one goal at 7-6 through three quarters at Walsh Stadium. North Andover simply went back to what it does best, deny and defend. That combination led to the number 8 seed Knights to a 9-6 victory over number 25 seed Central in a Division 1 state tournament round of 32 battle. The win advances the Knights to a round of 16 and will host number 9 seed Catholic Memorial, with the date and time yet to be announced. This was too close for comfort, and it really is really hard. Really hard when you beat a team twice by 9 and 10 goals. It's high school kids, so it's all about discipline. Okay, and another section from the sports is Central's Kearney named MVC Division 1 Player of the Year. Just as Central Catholics dominated the Merrimack Valley Conference this spring, its top hitter, Nathan Kearney, was the choice as a D1 MVP as selected by the coaches. Central's John Sexton was chosen as the MVC's D1 Coach of the Year. D2 champ Chelmsford saw sophomore Matt Stewart selected as Player of the Year, while his mentor Lou Diasti took home Coach of the Year honors. Here's a look at the all-conference selections in the MVC. First team all-conference and the second team all-conference were area players only. Okay, over to you, Matt.
All right. This next article is from the social issues section, titled LGBTQ Americans Under Attack, declared by the Human Rights Campaign. The Human Rights Campaign recently declared a state of emergency for LGBTQ people in the U.S. on Tuesday and released a quote-unquote guidebook for action, summarizing what it calls discriminatory laws in each state, along with Know Your Rights information about health and safety resources. Sounding the alarm about the current political environment, the nation's largest organization devoted to the rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer individuals said advisories warning against travel to dangerous places aren't enough to help people already living in so-called hostile states. The campaign said it's taking action in response to an unprecedented and dangerous spike in discriminatory legislation sweeping state houses this year, with more than 525 anti-LGBTQ plus introduced and more than 70 signed into law in 2023, more than double last year's number. In a report released Tuesday called, quote, LGBTQ Americans Under Attack, end quote, it says the new laws are a result of coordinated Republican efforts supported by, quote-unquote, well-funded extremist groups. The LGBTQ Americans Fight Back Guidebook, meanwhile, also provides information about filing for different types of complaints for violations about civil rights and points to resources for financing moves and finding employment in what it calls safer states. In a section called Know the Enemy / Opposition, the guidebook offers tips on how to engage in local advocacy opposing anti-LGBTQ efforts and how to navigate tough conversations about hate with friends and family. The guidebook aims to help millions of vulnerable people, whether they're planning summer travel through regions that are increasingly hostile to LGBTQ people, or whether they already live in a state where legislative assaults and political extremism are continuing to put a target on our backs, Kelly Robinson, president of the Human Rights Campaign, said in a statement. This emergency declaration is the first in the 40-year history of the HRC and comes as Republican-dominated legislatures have around the country passed bills targeting people based on their identities, including laws restricting various aspects of transgender existence, from pronoun usage and bathroom access to medical care and more. Among the latest of a series of bills nearing final passage in Louisiana would broadly ban K-12 public school employees in Louisiana from discussing sexual orientation or gender identity in the classroom. The legislation is similar to the Florida law critics dubbed Don't Say Gay, This article includes a picture of many protesters standing outside the Senate chamber in the Indiana State House on February 22, 2023 in Indianapolis. The Human Rights Campaign declared a state of emergency for LGBTQ people, including a guidebook summarizing discriminatory laws, along with Know Your Rights, information, and health and safety resources. All right, Bianca, back to you.
This next article is from the opinion section, and it says, government must act on drug shortages. So America has a drug problem. Namely, there is not a reliable supply of life-saving medications needed to treat diseases ranging from diabetes to pediatric cancer. The nation is regularly beset by shortages of vital drugs, and doctors and hospitals have little warning when the vital treatment goes missing. There were 295 active medication shortages at the end of last year, according to the report from the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. That's a 30% increase from 2021. Treatments in short supply and report notes range from drugs used in hospital emergency rooms to treat cancer, prescription medications, and even common over-the-counter treatments like children's cold and flu medicine. Any parent who scrambled to find a kid's Tylenol this winter can attest to that. Chemotherapy drugs, particularly those used to treat childhood cancers, have been chronically in short supply. These are the backbones of curative regimens. A pediatric hematologist, oncologist, and facility member of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics told the Washington Post, "We don't have alternatives, and it's not like I can substitute a particular scarce chemotherapy agent with another. This isn't a strep throat or some other infection where I don't have amoxicillin. I can swap it out for something that's probably, if not as good, almost as good." As a Senate report notes, shortages continue to have devastating consequences for patients and healthcare providers, including medication errors and treatment delays, and in some cases have led to doctors having to ration life-saving treatments. There are a number of factors that brought us here. Chief among them is the fact that the profit-driven pharmaceutical companies give short shrift to generic drugs. These drugs that are in short supply are not the blockbusters that pharmaceutical companies make big bucks from. They are older, generic, injectable drugs that companies don't make a huge profit on. Not many companies make generic drugs these days, and if a company goes out of business or decides to stop making a particular medication, doctors and patients are out of luck. What's more is the active ingredients in many of the medications come from India and China, 80% of the estimates. A problem there is that, or a shaky supply chain can spell disaster. Meanwhile, government regulators have little to no idea how the supply chain is working at any one time. The first step toward a solution has to be ramping up the production of medication, specifically generic medication, here at home. The Senate committee recommends private-public partnerships that incentivize strategic onshoring for critical generic drugs and having the federal government sign long-term contracts with domestic suppliers. There also are more transparency in the supply chain. Too often in recent years, we don't learn about shortages until they're already happening. Regulators need to be able to anticipate and react to crises before they occur, and that isn't happening right now, so there needs to be more transparency. Simply put, it comes down to money, and when one considers that the U.S. is not able to efficiently manufacture life-saving medication, if we were in a pinch, this should evoke in all of us some degree of embarrassment and alarm. Even as we talk our technological advancements in the field of medicine, and especially cancer care on a daily basis, but the government needs to step it up to protect patients, ensuring that there's a supply of drugs to cure their cancers when curative therapies are available. I'm a researcher, and I wouldn't spend another dollar on research before solving the shortage problem. Back to you, Matt.
All right. Thank you. This next story is titled, from the politics section, "Conservatives Block GOP Bills Voice Frustrations." House conservatives staged a mini revolt Tuesday in retaliation for Speaker Kevin McCarthy's leadership on last week's vote to raise the debt ceiling. The right wing banding together to block progress on a mixture of bills and vent their frustration. led by outspoken members of the House Freedom Caucus. A group of 11 Republicans broke with their party on an otherwise routine procedural vote that threw the day's schedule and the rest of the week into disarray. It's the first such procedural rule vote to fail in nearly two decades. The group is among some of the same conservative Republicans who tried to stop the debt ceiling bill from advancing last week, and who then threatened to oust McCarthy after passage of that debt ceiling bill that President Joe Biden signed into law. Short of taking that step, they have demanded a meeting with McCarthy, leaving it unclear how the standoff will be resolved. "We're frustrated with the way that this is taking place," said Representative Matt Gaetz, the Republican from Florida, one of the more outspoken members of the group. "We're not going to live in the era of the Imperial Speaker, anymore. At issue is not just a gas stove bill and others that are now indefinitely stalled as the conservatives wage their protest, but the political standing of the House Republican majority. McCarthy is working on just a four-seat majority, which gives a small block of lawmakers considerable power to try and gain concessions from him. We're trying to resolve internal tensions within the House, and from time to time you have to have an airing within your family, and I think that's part of what just happened today," said Representative Patrick McHenry, a Republican from North Carolina. Just hours earlier, Republican leaders were extolling how the House Republicans have learned to work together as a team after the rocky start of the year and the spectacle of McCarthy's protracted election to become Speaker. "In sports, it's called a game plan," said Tom Emmer, a Republican from Minnesota, the top GOP vote counter and a former hockey coach. "The debt limit last week displayed just how far House Republicans have come as a team. What led the conservatives to revolt Tuesday is not fully clear. They outlined a list of grievances over McCarthy's leadership in handling the debt ceiling package. The House approved the package in an overwhelming bipartisan vote last week, despite objectives from the conservatives, sending it to the Senate, where it also passed with an overwhelming vote. Biden signed it into law on Saturday. Republican Dan Bishop from North Carolina said that the group was now demanding that McCarthy meet with them to hash out an agreement for how the House would operate in the future. "We had an agreement that had been forged by all of us together, and it was utterly jettisoned unilaterally by the Speaker," Bishop said, "and there's been nothing so far to address the consequences of that." Asked if it's about the debt ceiling, Representative Ralph Norman, a Republican from South Carolina, said it's about a lot of things. Norman said the group is seeking what we insisted in January: truthfulness, sincere cuts, and putting economic security on the floor. It took McCarthy 14 failed votes in January to become Speaker, among objections from the conservative flank, a spectacle unseen in modern times. He finally seized the gavel on the 15th try after making concessions to a number of the Freedom Caucus members. One issue that has frustrated conservatives in particular is an upcoming vote to reverse a Biden administration firearms regulation called pistol braces, a stabilizing feature championed by some members of the Freedom Caucus. Some conservatives said House GOP leaders delayed consideration of the bill after members voted last week against the debt package. Representative Andrew Klein, a member of the House Freedom Caucus and gun shop owner who backed the bill, met with McCarthy on Tuesday afternoon. They said he discussed his pistol-based bill and received assurance it would get a vote on the House floor next week. "I will hold them to this promise," Clyde said in a tweet, "and I will never back down in the fight to defend our natural rights." The passage of the debt ceiling bill was hailed by McCarthy and other members of GOP leadership as a crucial first test of their new majority as they pushed Biden to the negotiating table and for spending restraints on Republicans have long championed in return for lifting the nation's debt limit. All right, back to you, Bianca.
This is from the behavioral section, so it says that police designate patrol officers as LGBTQIA+ liaisons. In behavioral police officials say that the department has designated two patrol officers as liaisons to the city's LGBTQIA+ community. Officials said that the goal of the two officers is to bridge the gap between the law enforcement and in the community, as the department is committed to ensuring the safety, protection, and equality of life for all queer citizens. "We respect and appreciate the diversity in our community and feel that all individuals should feel confident when reporting crimes," the department deputy chief Stephen Doherty said, "and we and he said that the liaison officers will provide guidance and resources to the community, help create an inclusive workplace, and work closely with community members to discuss any queer-related issues, but it's not their sole function. He said that they will still carry out the tasks of patrol officers. Doherty said that the program has been under development for the past few months and is still in its infancy. This is also from Haverhill. It says Founders Day celebration is this Saturday. The Ray of Light Recovery Cafe, located at 92 Merrimack Street, second floor, will hold its second Founders Day celebration in Gar Park on Saturday, June 10th from noon to 6 p.m. We are all invited to this event celebrating recovery from alcohol and drug dependency. This event will feature a panel of speakers who will discuss their own recovery and building recovery community. Also, free hamburgers and hot dog cookout, along with salads and other items, will be included, and yard games such as cornhole tosses and live music will be available. For more information, please contact Diana at 603-489-7061. And lastly, talk on shoe shop. So in Haverhill, the Buttonwoods Museum will host guest lecturer Sarah Grin, who talks about the 10-footer shoe shop's history and living traditions. This is going to be held on Thursday, June 22nd, and the lecture is at 6:30 p.m. It is free. This talk is sponsored by the grant from the Haverhill Cultural Council. Okay, back to you, Matt.
All right. I've got a couple of letters to the editor. The first is titled, quote-unquote, So-Called First Amendment Auditors. Your article, First Amendment Auditors Stop and Roll, Leading to Confusion and Confrontations, raised two questions in my mind. First, the First Amendment protects our freedom of speech, the right to press, the assembly, and the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. What part of it are these so-called auditors auditing? No part of that is apparent to me. Second, how can the harassing actions of these so-called auditors be considered auditing? I think our local governments should train their employees to treat these so-called auditors with reasonable respect, to keep their cool, not to waste our tax money, spending time and energy, being overly nice to them, and respond to any harassment by calling the cops. That's a letter from Thomas Hayden in Chelmsford. Next is the final walk at Green Meadow Golf Club. After 62 years of operation, Green Meadow Golf Club closed its doors this year. I golfed there since I was 13 and was saddened when I learned the decision was final. For 25 years, I was a member of the GM Inner Club and participated in league and tournament events. I looked forward to playing at Green Meadow every week. Last week, something drew me to drive there and walk the courses for a final time. For a couple of hours, I paced the fairways room to straw like I did for all those years. I took in the once pristine greens, now reduced to bumpy stubble. I noticed the patches of weeds growing in the bunkers. The courses were starkly quiet and still, temporarily returned to nature and wildlife till the ultimate development of the land. It was as if a once living and thriving organism of activity and enjoyment had finally come to a quiet death. I thought of probably millions of faces, swings, and smiles over the years. Ralph Calloway and Don Green, after him, ran the Inner Club for decades. Both now deceased, they were bigger-than-life characters who gave their all to the golfers and the two courses they loved. I felt their spirit from above. Golf courses are special, and for me, it's a sad day when any are sold and developed. As a friend to me, Green Meadow was the place we always wanted to be. That's a letter from Paul Thomas in Draycott. Hi, Bianca, back to you.
We are actually going to be wrapping up, so thank you for listening to Lowell Association of the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways you can listen to Lab Radio. You can request a free specialized radio receiver. Or for more information about our radio reading service, you can call Lab at 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lab at radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069 or visiting our website at lowellassociationoftheblind.org. Thank you for all of our Centennial sponsors for their support. This has been Bianca and Matt. Thank you for listening. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. Turning cloudy today, temperatures in the upper 60s. Some showers are possible. Cloudy overnight, temperatures dropping down to the lower 50s for Thursday. mostly cloudy, temperatures in the mid-60s. The sun rose this morning at 5:08, setting at 8:19 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
Newton's Carroll Center for the Blind, one of the largest vision rehabilitation agencies in the nation, will host its 11th annual Walk for Independence on Saturday, June 3rd, from 8 a.m. to noon. It's a family-friendly event, bringing together both sighted and visually impaired individuals to support the nonprofit organization's mission. Walkers can choose either a 1, 2, or 3 mile stroll around the Mount Ida campus of UMass Amherst, located at 100 Carlson Avenue in Newton, and then stay for complimentary food, music, accessible games, and fun giveaways. Guide dogs and family pets on leashes are welcome. Individuals and teams can register at www.carroll.org/walk. That's www.carroll.org/walk.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station, Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF.